Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Are you a fan of NPR's Kitchen Sisters? I just love them. I've been fans and friends of Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson for a long time. On this week's show, we sit down with the Kitchen Sisters to discuss their amazing trajectory on NPR, as well as how they came to find Hidden Kitchens. With their help, we'll even hear from heavyweight champion George Foreman about his famous grill, the tool used in many hidden kitchens of the homeless. Then we'll ride shotgun with the Trinity Loaves and Fishes team as they take their hidden kitchen to the homeless and hungry of Central City. We're learning from the greats and feeding the masses on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Nikki Silva of the Kitchen Sisters.
I'm Davia Nelson, the other half of the Kitchen Sisters.
Long before This American Life and the podcast revolution, the Kitchen Sisters were two of NPR's original documentarians. For the past four decades, Davia and Nikki have been unearthing stories, often in kitchens, and sharing what they call shards of sound from around the world. During their last visit to New Orleans, we invited Davia and Nikki over to our Southern Food and Beverage Museum kitchen to learn how they first met and became the Kitchen Sisters.
We both went to college in Santa Cruz, at UC Santa Cruz. We didn't know each other when we were in college. We had never met. But afterwards, Davia was doing radio. She's always been in love with radio for forever and was working at a little community station in Santa Cruz, KUSP, and became kind of very involved in oral history, wanting to interview the old-timers, get to the root of things. And I was working at the local Natural History Museum, but I was doing history and art exhibits. And we kind of found ourselves on the same beat. Like, Davia would go and talk to some old-timer, and I would have been there borrowing that old-timer's artifacts and getting their stories. And I had a friend who happened to be Davia's boyfriend at the moment, and he knew me, and he kept saying, you know, you need to meet this person. And so finally we met. She came to the museum one day. We sat on the porch overlooking Monterey Bay, and I think she got there around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we talked until about 8 o'clock at night and sort of just fell in love at that moment, and it kind of went on from there.
You're listening to KUSP in Santa Cruz. With us today on the Kitchen Sisters is Led Engelsman. Led has been out at Wilder Ranch since 1929, and we've been badgering Led for probably...
So, Davia, the name Kitchen Sisters, so how does that project then get started?
We started doing radio together, and in the meantime, Nikki and a group of people had bought land together and were starting a commune. It was one of the first nights at the place, and there was this sort of rundown small house, real ramshackle, with a funky stove, and Nikki and I were cooking salmon for the group. And at the same time, we had a weekly show called Every Wrinkle Tells a Story. It was an oral history show on KUSP, and we were preparing for next Tuesday's show. This was a Saturday night. We're kind of looking through this book. It was the Sidewalk Companion to Santa Cruz Architecture. We were trying to find a story that would kind of catch us and what we might ask him about. And we came across this story on the Kitchen brothers, who are two actual brothers, Kenneth and Robert Kitchen, who were stonemasons in Santa Cruz and during World War II built yogi temples and goat milk bars and tried to send and receive messages to submarines they thought were lurking out in Monterey Bay. And we got captivated. Already the stove was funky. Our attention span was about that. And we just started calling ourselves the Kitchen Sisters as we were cooking, and we derailed, and the salmon dinner went basically up in smoke. And then when we got on the air that week, when the guy came to be interviewed, we said, well, tell us the story of the Kitchen Brothers, not to be confused with the Kitchen Sisters who are here with you today. And our names are confusing, Davia Nelson, Nikki Silva, and we were interviewing a lot of elders, and they could never say our names well, so we just, it just kind of went from there, and somebody made a bumper sticker that said, Free the Kitchen Sisters, and it was during that era, so it just became.
Another odd connection, because what year did you, were you all in Santa Cruz?
1979.
I was too.
No, come on.
I lived across from the police station. And I worked at the old theater cafe. That was my first kitchen job.
You're kidding.
No.
I had no idea.
It's really, I have goosebumps.
Kitchen sister, Poppy Tucker.
See, there is no
Santa Cruz connection.
No accidents in life.
We weren't doing food at all at that moment. We didn't do food stories for another 25 years, really. I mean, food was always there in the wings. You know, you can't do stories and not and tell people's life story without food being part of it and an important part of it, but it wasn't the center of our focus at all. That would come to Hidden Kitchens, you know, many, many years later.
I think food just flowed through absolutely every interview. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're talking to someone about because food really warms up the conversation. I mean, if you find yourself lagging and you find someone uncomfortable or stiff, just start asking some questions about childhood food or what they had for breakfast, and you'll be amazed to where the conversation goes. So the seed was planted. It was always there, but we didn't frame it as food at that point.
And what sparked Hidden Kitchens?
It's funny, with the work we do, our ideas are sort of percolating. Often they take years to really come bubble up to the surface. We had been doing a project called Lost and Found Sound. That was for the Millennium. It was on NPR Weekly, how sound shaped history, how history shaped by sound, people possessed by sound, endangered languages, sound on the verge of extinction. Then after that, we did a project called the Sonic Memorial Project, which was looking at the whole lower Manhattan area through sound and building a memorial in sound.
After
9/11. And with both those projects, we had opened up phone lines on NPR, on Morning Edition and on All Things Considered, and asked people to call in about their recordings or what they felt needed to be chronicled before it was about to be gone. And the origin myth of Hidden Kitchens is this. I live in San Francisco. I hate to drive. I take a lot of cabs. And I would notice that every time I got in a yellow cab, the driver was from Brazil. And not just from Brazil, but the same town in Brazil, Goiânia. And it turns out, we later found out, 436 drivers were from this one town in Brazil. And Nikki and I had done a bunch of projects in Brazil in the past, and I'd studied some Portuguese and knew the music and knew the food. And so, you know, we just get in these conversations in the cab. And then one of the drivers one day said, you should really go over to Jeanette's kitchen. I was like, turned out there's a woman from Goiânia who would come every night at midnight. And outside on this abandoned industrial street outside the yellow cab yard, she set up this mobile rolling night kitchen. And she would cook Brazilian food for the cab drivers. And not just the Brazilian cab drivers, the Iranian cab drivers, the Russian cab drivers, the Southern cab drivers. And she had this little sort of blue tarp. And this, the cab doors would all be open and Brazilian music was blaring. And she had this little scene. And they said, oh, just make it look like you work for Yellow Cab. Just go park in the parking lot and just walk out and look like you know what you're doing and come out the other side of the cab yard. So we went one night at midnight. They drew us a little map. We followed the map out to it. And there, as we say, it was a hidden kitchen vision. Jeanette, this music, this her little boy was asleep in the car, cooking away. We spent this night and we kept going.
Jeanette's the place where we take a break when we are hungry.
Then the good word started to spread out, and now the whole neighborhood, you know, comes here.
Aí ficou brasileiro, americano, né? Quer dizer, todas as...
The people that deliver papers use that street, and musicians stop by to eat. They started to play too when I put out chairs on the street. Then there was the World Cup. We put out the TV set.
And we kept going back and back and back, and we went, well, if Jeanette is cooking on this street corner, who else is out there? What else don't we know about? Then we started saying, who's cooking on your corner? Who are your local kitchen pioneers and visionaries? What traditions and kitchen rituals are endangered and need to be chronicled? So we opened up the phone line again on Morning Edition and asked that question, and what was it, 2,789 minutes of messages came in, 36 CDs worth of phone messages came in with calls.
And so then you go and discover these hidden kitchens.
Or they discovered us.
And I think the larger idea, too, behind it was these hidden kitchens, but how communities come together through food. I mean, that was really what we began to see and imagine. And we imagined all kinds of hidden kitchens. We'd sit there and we'd write lists of, oh, yeah, and then there's the test kitchen, and then there's the space kitchen, and then there's the this and the that. And but really, opening up those phone lines, it was just staggering. We hadn't even ever imagined the kinds of calls and ideas that people brought to the table around this idea of hidden kitchens. And the piece that opened the entire series was, I think, one of the most astounding messages we got.
Message 23 was received at 1:10 p.m. today.
I'm Margaret Engel. A woman who works for Legal Aid was talking to me about how many of her clients get dinner. The people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like. The George Foreman grill.
Homeless people and new immigrants use the grill as a hidden kitchen. I mean, the people on the street are plugging into the telephone poles, and the people in these apartments where they're not supposed to have a kitchen are disguising their George Foreman grill, and, you know, so they don't get busted, and they're creating their own kitchens out of, you know, putting ice in buckets and for refrigerators, and it just opened this world. And we knew, I think, from the get-go that we wanted to do stories that were beyond, oh, yeah, this is a great place to eat, or this is the newest thing in town kind of thing. And we knew we wanted to do stories about hunger and poverty and the flip side of food, the dark side of food. But that phone call, that idea of the George Foreman grill really gave us this backdoor way into a subject which we wanted to deal with through an amazing story. So I think the phone line was pretty key to the series.
How did heavyweight boxer George Foreman's name become forever inextricably tied to an early electric countertop grill? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
I can't run, but I can walk much faster than this. Can't run, but I can't run, but I can walk much faster than this. Can't run, but
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, where this summer you can choose from over a dozen of Chef Chip Flanagan's inventive small plates and sip a glass of wine for an affordable, light, seasonal meal, overlooking the lush foliage and towering oaks of City Park at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How did heavyweight boxer George Foreman's name become forever inextricably tied to an early electric countertop grill? Let's let the former world champion himself tell us the story as he explained it to the Kitchen Sisters.
Growing up in Houston, Texas, my whole life was spent trying to get enough to eat. having 7 kids, my mother did, and there just was never enough food for me. I always dreamed about not a car, not a beautiful home, but enough to eat.
My name, Piggly Wiggly.
Every day at lunch during the summer days, you'd hear the parents call the kids in. They would just tell me, okay, go home and eat your lunch. And these people knew I had no food at home. And I'd peep through the window at the kids eating, and the parents would peel the crust off the bread, and I would sit there and just hope they would just throw it out the window for me. Going to school, you go through the lunch line, 26 cents. I couldn't afford that, and I'd sit at the table, and it was so embarrassing. So what I would do, I'd get a greasy bag, blow it up on the way to school to make it look like there was a sandwich in it. Then I'd get to my classroom and say, boy, I ate my lunch. And I learned to disguise my not having food. In 1977, when I left boxing, I realized I didn't have any friends. People weren't pouring into my home anymore. And I noticed if I'd barbecue something, they would come over. Even the guys would go fishing. I wanted them to stay and come back so much, I would always clean the fish, do all the cooking. I found out more satisfying than even winning boxing matches when people would lick their fingers and say my food was good. That grill, I'm just happy that it's helped so many people, helped me, of course. My brother Roy and I started the George Foreman Youth Center. I have these summer camps so the kids can know to come. They can have a lunch every day. Just had to be there for them. I'll never forget. And I'm pushed and compelled. I mean, there's a food bank. All you got to do is ask George Foreman. If I can find a dime, I'm going to make sure you get it. I try to keep those little visions alive for myself. Feed them.
And what's George's favorite thing to cook on his famous grill? Salmon steak. He makes a marinade with garlic, lemon pepper, black pepper, balsamic vinegar, and a little oil. He marinates the salmon for a very short time and then puts it on the grill. So as he says, the smell is there. Everybody loves smells. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. And now, our conversation with Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, NPR's renowned kitchen sisters, continues.
There was a Louisiana tie-in in Hidden Kitchens.
Many a Louisiana tie-in. I mean, if you look at that archive of calls out of those 2,789 minutes of messages, I would say, I just haven't looked in years, but I bet you there are 30 to 50 calls from Louisiana. I mean, Texas, Louisiana, those states were some of the most juicy. It kind of clustered up, and Louisiana kind of led the charge.
And so one of those Louisiana calls led you to Angola Prison?
Yeah. There were so many of those calls and so many stories to do. And that story didn't come to be until after Katrina. Even though we had seen this call come through, we just hadn't gotten to it yet. We'd heard about a man.
We wrote about it in our book, and we cited the message because it was such an amazing message, but it was on our to-do list.
A woman who's a great social activist here in town called in to tell us about a man who was in Angola Penitentiary, and while he was there, he was part of the Angola Three. He was in solitary confinement for 29 years, ultimately let out, found not guilty. But while in solitary, he created a clandestine kitchen in his cell, and he made pralines. Because Angola has the pecans, the milk, the butter, every ingredient. And when this food was being brought into him, the trustees would sort of sneak that extra little bit of something in there. And he kind of created a Coke can kitchen, had a little bit of foil and all these things, and kind of was able to craft these pralines. He had worked in the prison kitchen, too. And he'd been obsessed with candy as a boy, watching his grandmother make candy. And so we'd heard about him. But Nikki saw, after Katrina, saw various listservs, and King Wilkerson was listed, Robert King Wilkerson, as one of the missing people, and had anyone found him, and she remembered the message. And so after Katrina, We were keeping our eyes open for him, and when he kind of surfaced, we then started to talk to him and tell his story.
I think I cried more in those 16 days that I was in the house after Katrina than I did in 31 years I did in prison. It not only took so much away from me as an individual, it replicated this hundreds of thousands of times. I think Candy is a collateral. My doing what I'm doing, keeping focus on the injustices that were taking place in Angola. If doing so by cooking, making candy, opening up kitchen can produce money to aid them, so be it. Maybe that's my calling.
So after the King story aired on NPR, we got the most amazing message from Angola. And they said, we love the Kitchen Sisters down here, which was the first thing, kind of a surprise to us that they were listening. And they said, but we want to invite the Kitchen Sisters down here because, you know, we have this rodeo and we have these things happening, and we want to show them that you really couldn't do a hidden kitchen in solitary, that this isn't possible. So anyway, we said, of course we want to come.
We're making chicken on a stick with mushroom and onions. They sell like hotcakes. My name is Franklin Green. I've been here going on 24 years. I was sentenced to life on drug charge. Since I come here, I've given my life to the law. We have a saying in Angola that you can be in Angola, but Angola don't have to be in you.
It was after Katrina, and there was this fear that a lot of the food was being lost, blown away by the storm, and it's this one little spot at Angola where the traditions were being continued on this little sideline. We just came to document that and see that, which was an amazing thing. And so afterwards, you know, we weren't very convinced that King couldn't have done that in solitary. So we said to King, you know, King, they said that they don't think you could have been doing that hidden kitchen in your cell in solitary. And he goes, well, I guess that's why they call it a hidden kitchen. So.
I'd like to talk with you all a little bit about National Public Radio. Would you just unravel for us the importance of National Public Radio and why you've chosen that to be your platform?
What a great question, Poppy. What a surprise that that's what we're talking about in your kitchen. When we first started on National Public Radio, it was an experiment. I mean, it was so new, and no one even knew really what it was or what it might sound like, but there was this commitment made to unfettered expression, free expression of ideas from all points of view, and also in as artistic and high-quality a way as possible, with people who are really informed about ideas, people whose ideas had never been heard, whose voices were traditionally left out of the mediums, who were being ignored by the media, and also to a system that would come to be hundreds of stations, a network that has a national presence, but then also a local presence, so that it's strong on two levels. We've been doing stories on NPR for decades, and I only feel that all the more when you just see how much pressure there is on what can be told on a commercial station for fear of offending a sponsor, for creating a controversy, and people don't want a controversy for a station that represents only one side of a story, either whether that's more progressive or that's more conservative, whereas representing a full spectrum of ideas. And also, it's a medium, too, where so many people can participate in it. The tools of radio are pretty accessible, are very learnable. You can become part of this network, but there's so little civil discussion. There's so much rage and provocation and bombast and hostility and drawing of lines and polarization in the culture. And NPR and PRI and the Public Radio Exchange, all the different outlets in public radio, still remain so committed to civil discourse, to discussion, to airing ideas with mutual respect.
And I think just like your show right now, I mean, it's the idea of digging deeper beyond the soundbite. Oh, and especially now that there's the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't catch the person's mind or eye or ear in, what is it, like 2 seconds, you've lost them. But you know, there's an appetite for listening longer. There's an appetite for going beyond. And I think that NPR, although straddling all those same kinds of issues, they really do push it. They really, more than any other network.
When you're looking at the future of this medium that you ladies have been very accomplished in for decades, what do you think is coming next?
See, I was just going to say, I think, like for us, because now we're doing a podcast, we have a podcast that comes out 2 times a month. And ironically, what I feel it's doing is taking us back to our very early roots, which was live radio. I mean, it's giving us that time to explore and expand and take a tangent and take a side road and, you know, just let the mind go and do a highly produced story, like a 7-minute story or a 6.5-minute story that we have the time constraints on. And when we do something on Morning Edition, it's, you know, 6.5, 7.5 minutes long, period. Well, to take that and use it as the centerpiece, but then to kind of spin off of that and to think beyond that and to really push it out there. What a great gift that is. I mean, that's very much like the old days, but it's pushing it out in very new ways in terms of the technology and the delivery system, which is exciting to me.
Gary Cannell was president of NPR a few regimes ago. And when he first came into NPR, he said this phrase, which I love. He said, "Radio isn't going anywhere. It's going everywhere." And I think, to me, radio is radio, but radio is also a state of mind, which is listening. Right now, when we started in public radio, there was so little out there. And to produce the kind of radio that we were doing, non-narrated, highly layered, deeply produced, with archival audio, music, sound, field recordings, interviews, making it so that they felt like small movies. You know, there was maybe 3-4 other people in the country, maybe 20 in the world doing that. Now you look around and so many people have taken on this craft, are doing such incredible work in it, delving deep into their subject matter and really inventing something. It asks everyone in the culture to be more alert, to be your own curator, to have a sense of all the different newspapers and news sources you might hear and the sonic sources you might hear, and maybe to pick up those tools and create it for yourself, and to make sure that the stories around you that you're not hearing on the media are getting chronicled. You know, that's part of being a citizen, is listening and passing it along.
Well, this has been such an incredible treat to have this chance to visit with you all. And I hope you never, ever come back to New Orleans without visiting us again.
Right back at you, Poppy, because we have sat in admiration so much of what you do, how you chronicle the culture and the traditions of food in Louisiana and elsewhere. And this, that Joan of Arc spirit that you have, you know, that these stories matter, that these people matter, that the ground that is being farmed, the water is being fished and shrimped, that it all matters and has to be nurtured and cared for and celebrated.
You better come on.
Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, the Kitchen Sisters. Nikki and Davia have made a career chronicling a wide range of cultures and traditions, with stories often focused on the lives of individuals and groups below the radar. Inspired by their work, Louisiana Eats set out to explore 2 communities in New Orleans who gather together through food. One is a set of volunteers from Trinity Episcopal Church, the Loaves and Fishes team, who prepare and deliver meals. The other is the community to whom they cater, the homeless, the transient, and those simply in need of a meal.
Gotta find my gloves.
I first learned about Trinity's Loaves and Fishes mobile food truck during a church service when the 10th anniversary of the program was celebrated. Volunteers meet 6 days a week in Bishop Polk Hall to prepare enough simple meals to feed hundreds.
Okay, so we're going to do all of these, and then we got two loaves of bread to do.
We joined one group on an early Saturday morning, just as they were beginning the process of unpacking bags filled with bread, deli meat, and cheese. After spreading a sheet of white paper onto a long folding table, volunteers began the process of assembling sandwiches.
Yeah, there's 20 per bag for peanut butter jelly.
Oh, wow, that's a lot, isn't it?
It's 100.
Well, that's like about 100.
My name is Scott Webster, and I'm the coordinator for Trinity Loaves and Fishes. It was formed right after Katrina. All the volunteers did was made as many meals as possible, got in the truck, and then drive down to all the different wards and see volunteers rebuilding or people just on the street that just needed a meal, needed a bottle of water. And it's just really simple, ham and cheese or peanut butter and jelly. Hard-boiled eggs and fruit have really become a bigger staple and something that our clients really enjoy. And then chips and cookies. It started to morph probably halfway through, like 5 years after, when we started to see a decline in the amount of volunteers coming down to help with reconstruction and the homeless population really starting to get larger. And our mission is always kind of changing, which is good for us. We're able to help a larger array of people. And for some people, when it's in the morning, it's a really good start to your day. You just feel like you've accomplished something, you've helped give a meal to someone who might not have known where their next meal was coming from.
So my name is Lisa, and I have been doing Loaves and Fishes for 10 years. When Loaves and Fishes first started right after Katrina, I really just felt a pull to do this. I can't really explain why. I mean, it was fairly shortly after the storm, and I didn't lose my house, and I didn't lose my job, and my city was in shambles, and I really just wanted to find some way to give back. And I heard about this, and I just thought, that's for me. And 10 years later, it's still for me. It just means serving the poor, really. And we actually serve the homeless very close to where Trinity Church is. It's just a mile or so away, and we thought we really need to serve the people who are in need in our own backyard.
Perfect. I'm Ivra. I work here in the maintenance department, and I always did want to do volunteer work. And when I saw this here, I got on board, love it. I've been here for like a year and a half now, helping them serve. The good thing to me about it, what I like about it, when we go out there and serve, we pull back in the truck, I feel like $1 million. I just feel like I did all I could do for the day. You know, I feel real good about myself. I love it. I love it. Just a beautiful group here. I'm not leaving this group.
My name is David Wurzel. I've been working here. It's been about 4.5 years. And when we go out on the truck out to the mission area, and we've been to a few other areas as well, the one thing I find that's very interesting is, as I've been told, and I didn't realize how little things make such a big difference, when we prepare a bag, and if you notice, we don't make the bags up here, we just make the food sandwiches together, we ask, what would you like to have in the bag? And it to me, that makes a big difference. I feel like we're connecting. We're making a connection with some of the folks that really are on the needy side of the city.
After the final meal was bagged up, all the food was carted to the truck waiting outside. In addition to the prepared meals, the truck was being loaded with a variety of bags of chips, sweet treats, and drinks. On the other side, the truck offered clean used clothing, toiletries, and books.
So it's basically a Ford F-250 pickup truck that has a big silver box on the back of it, and the sides of the silver box and the back of the box open up, the doors flip up, and it has shelves on it, and that's where we have the food. The back of the truck that flips open is our beverage service area. It has built-in beverage service dispensers. It actually has a place that you can warm hot dogs, but we've never actually used that part.
There is a water just container area. We put bottles of water, and on a day like today where it's warmer, we will just cover it with a couple big things of ice, keep them cool on the trip over. And then there's slanted shelving. And what we like to do is do kind of a mirror image. We'll do a mirror image for the sandwiches because we make a considerably larger amount of ham and cheese. And so instead of having volunteers reach over each other to get certain sandwiches, we put all the peanut butters in the central location, ham and cheese on the sides. And then same for the chips and the cookies. We like to alternate patterns just so it's easier for someone to grab what someone's asked for.
Beverage as usual.
Okay, and
I think Teresa's going to do clothes. I get to drive in, have a second set of keys. You're riding with Scott?
Right.
Do we know where Scott is?
No.
Okay, hey, Mary Beth.
He went in.
See if Scott's in there. Teresa's riding with him.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, we journey with Trinity's Loaves and Fishes food truck as it makes its way to the corner of Aretha Castle Haley and Clio Street to deliver the goods. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. If you're just joining us, we've been spending a Saturday morning with volunteers from Trinity's Loaves and Fishes mobile food truck. With the truck packed to the brim with meals and beverages, it was time to deliver.
We're driving down O.C. Haley Boulevard, and we are headed toward the New Orleans Mission.
It's like a pretty good crowd today. We make a loop so they know we're coming, because most of them will be under the expressway or some shady place.
This is more tense than
this
I've ever seen
tense.
Before.
Yeah.
And you think summertime would be less tense in terms of sheltering.
You know, they keep talking about they're going to clear out under the expressway. We keep thinking, well, where will we serve when that happens? Well, that's not happening, so we don't have to worry about that.
Guys, you think I should go behind the car or in front of the car?
After making its initial pass, the truck parks at its usual spot on the corner of Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard and Clio Street. Scores of people gather as the truck pulls to a stop.
Okay, folks.
It's done.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. All right,
good morning.
Just be patient. Can I help you?
Ham and cheese?
No ham and cheese.
Some of the sites we have just working poor or people who have younger children and they're doing something to help with offsetting for the weekend budget if they have, you know, if they're getting SNAP funding and that funding's getting low and they need something to help carry them over until the next month, then we start to see a lot more of those families.
You don't get no sandwich, don't you get some eggs? Sandwich, eggs? Can I get two eggs?
Can I get us some?
Beginning of the month, usually we'll bring up fewer sandwiches out, but still a good amount today. We have 100 to 120 sandwiches on the truck. We open up in 30 minutes, it's gone.
Good morning. Hey! 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 Hey!
Not on a Wednesday.
I'm doing that.
There's a couple people who I even will see on the street, and then there's one gentleman, his name's Mr. Leo, and just goes around with his little scooter, and I can say hi to him, how's he doing, and it's just really interesting. I get a different look for seeing people on the street, and other friends of mine might, you know, neglect them, you know, not want to make eye contact, but I'll see how they're doing, because they're just people, and for some of them, it's just having that human interaction that they don't get on a regular basis.
There's John, who is always looking to get some extra snacks. He says he has children that he feeds in the project area or one place or another. There's a gentleman that always wore a very heavy coat and dreadlocks, although I haven't seen him in the last few months. You start to see some of the regular people who we're working with and helping to feed, and they're thankful. And when you don't see them, you start to wonder what's going on. Maybe things got better, maybe things got worse. You really don't know, but you can only hope.
After a while, I began to notice that many of those gathered had relocated around the corner and were now carrying styrofoam containers. We walked over and discovered dozens of people lining up behind a pickup truck. Sitting in a chair, surrounded by coolers, was a man in a tall cowboy hat and white tuxedo shirt, covered in telltale cooking stains. He was handing out hot meals to each person in line.
Uh-oh. It's marinated big to the bone. Thank
you. Come on, bro.
As the queue grew, a mentally and physically disabled man was assisted forward by a member of the line. Not everyone waiting their turn felt so generous about the gesture.
There is always the possibility of, with food insecurity, any kind of mishaps happening between the clients waiting. There was one time there was a fight. Someone thought they weren't going to get the sandwich. They thought it was almost out. It's hot during the summer. People really are just, you know, in the heat, burning up. They just want that food to go and get in the shade. And so then we took a hiatus. We told them our protocol is if anyone gets in a fight, we just have to close it up and leave for the safety of our volunteers. And so then we came back 2 weeks later, and people realized that this was something that they really, for a lot of them, they're living on the street. They needed this meal, and the people that got in the fight, like, apologized. They were, you know, taken aback because they missed getting that, you know, sustenance.
It's an issue of food insecurity. You know, there may be places for them to eat, but it's not necessarily regular. It's not necessarily easy. Our big thing is we don't judge. We don't ask for their life story. We don't ask them why they're here. You know, all we want to do is give them a warm, dignified transaction.
That's it. That's it. I hear you, but I ain't been up home. You want a drink, baby?
I have one.
Thank you.
When the final meal was served, we approached the gentleman in the back of the pickup truck to learn about his mission.
Okay, so what's your name?
Omar.
Sir? Omar,
yeah.
It's so nice to meet you. And so you come once a month on a Saturday. Every third Saturday. And why are you here?
Well, we have a lot of people in New Orleans that's homeless. And when I first started, I told the 5th District I would cook some food for them. I cooked about 75 dinners. I had about 35 left over. So I came out here, and when I saw the faces of those people who's hungry, that's when I started, October 2011. You know, but be God's will, every third Saturday you see me out here. We're at 110 mil. When they see my truck, first thing they say, that's the man with the hot meal. Because they know that what I give, you and I can eat. You know, you can pull one of these plates out and, you know, you got your nice, decent meal. You got spoons, fork, napkins, and everything. He got a little rude, that's the only one. But I used to talk to him and explain to them that I want to sing a line because everybody got to eat. One lady came out here, a Caucasian lady, she came out, she said, do you know about Southern hospitality? I said, yes, I do. Then I'm going to give me a play up. I said, but she got to get in line. I said, everybody else hungry too. Right. And they're down from the South. So, you know, she probably understood what I was saying. And that was that, you know. But I enjoy what I do. I go to the nursing home. I have a brother and a brother in the nursing home. Once a month, I bake 4 or 5 cakes and break some ice cream over there. And also, I got neighbors. I feed, you know, those who are in need. But that's it. And I'm always busy. I'm always trying to do something to help somebody. You know, I go get 3 cases of chicken, a leg quarter, and I clean all of it by myself, washing and cleaning. I go get it that Wednesday, and I prep it up for my season and put it in my refrigerator. And then I bake 5 cakes Thursday, you know, cut them up, get my bread, cut it up, put it in plastic containers. And I buy my potato salad from Sam's, you know, I prepare everything. And I have one lady that come help me to bag it. But when she don't come, I always be prepared to do it myself. I have did it maybe 10 times by myself, but I always be prepared, you know, so, because the people got to eat. Yeah.
What you've just heard is proof of the milk of human kindness. From the decade-old Trinity's Loaves and Fishes program to individuals like Omar, who find ways to personally make a difference for the city's homeless and hungry, people really are inherently good. They do care, and they do want to help. If you'd like to be involved in the ongoing Loaves and Fishes mission, or just make a donation, visit Trinity Episcopal's website at trinitynola.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
There's a bright golden haze in the meadow, yeah. There's a bright golden haze in the meadow.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we celebrate the 151st anniversary of Juneteenth, the day that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States, by visiting the Whitney Plantation, the only plantation museum in America with a focus on the slaves themselves.
John was born a slave here. In 1775, he became a free man of color. He was able to make some money and came back to this plantation and bought his father out of slavery. And he had to pay $20 to free him.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street. Also, home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. And by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.